You're listening to episode 59 of the Mentoring Developers podcast. Welcome.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
In this episode of Mentoring Developers, I'll be talking to David Gatti about internet security, about how to be secure, how to save yourselves from being attacked, being hacked, and also how to protect your users if you're a software developer. How do you protect your users from being compromised? We have some tips and tricks and strategies that you can employ. And certainly, this is not a comprehensive list, and we're not going to cover all the different points, but you're welcome to chime in, send me your emails, send me your tweets at mentoringdevs, email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com, and we will try to include you in the discussion. I think this is a very fascinating discussion for somebody. If you are somebody who has been thinking about security and how to keep users secure, how to do multi-factor or two-factor authentication and all that stuff, go ahead and give it a listen. I'll be waiting for your responses. Here it is, my discussion about security with David Gatti. Hi, everyone. This is Arsalan Ahmed with David Gatti again. David, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. And today we're going to talk about security, and not just security in the sense of how to keep our servers secure and how to build websites that don't get hacked. Those are important. We're going to talk about how we can keep our users secure and how we can avoid being hacked ourselves and how we can just have secure practices as developers, as software developers. If somebody is just starting out and they're saying, well, I'm going to learn all these new programming languages and frameworks, and I'm going to build cool apps, and they're not thinking about security, then they should pause, they should listen to this podcast, and they should really think about what they're doing and make sure that they're not skipping something that's important. And you had a personal experience with that. You had a website, and it got into really big trouble. So tell us a little bit about that, David.
Yeah, it was like a website a long time ago, like more than 10 years ago, that I developed myself. And back in the day, we used like the technology called FTP to transfer file to a server. And I had like on my Windows machine, this FTP client, and I decided to make my life easier by saving the password to my server, right? And by doing that, I run into a situation where like somehow I don't quite remember either I got an email or if I clicked somewhere. And I got a virus on my Windows machine, which detected that I'm using this FTP client, and it tried to access every website that I had in my favorite, right? And it found actually mine, which was at that time quite popular. I was getting like 7,000 views a day. So a bunch of people were like visiting it. And this virus basically updated my index.html file with like a piece of JavaScript code, and started infecting all my visitors with like a virus, right? And I quickly got like a bunch of messages saying like, hey, David, something is wrong. And I quickly fixed it. But it took me a while to understand like how someone, you know, accessed my server. And then after a while, I realized from Googling around that the FTP client that I was using had an interface, it also had like a command line interface, and that allowed for like a virus to very easily like use this client from the command line right in the background. And just only to make my life easier by saving the password, I compromised my security pretty badly. And after that situation, like I started taking security more seriously, and I started to make my life a little bit more annoying by not remembering passwords on default app.
So there are lots of things that we can do, and we can keep ourselves secure at different levels, right? So one thing is don't get hacked and don't get a virus. And one of the ways to do that would be to have long passwords, difficult to generate passwords if somebody just wants to randomly create numbers and letters and try to break your password, give them a hard time. So if it's a longer password, it's going to be harder. If it's more random, it's going to be harder. So that's one level. The other thing that you talked about earlier was the fact that we shouldn't have the same username password in every website. You can, and a lot of times we use email. So if you have one email address, your username is going to be the same. And maybe your password is going to be the same. So if somebody cracks your password on one website, they can try to get access to other websites using the same username password. And they don't even have to work hard for that, because there is a way to send you an email with a link to all these different websites. Or maybe it's a link to something else that actually triggers a call, maybe a form submission to a whole another website, and hoping that you're still logged in. So that's another type of attack. It's called CSERF. And you go in there and they can get access. Or they can themselves use your cracked username password and try to get access to any website. So if you're logged in to Facebook, maybe you use the same password as LinkedIn, maybe. So they can get access to your LinkedIn. Or maybe you're logged into your Yahoo email with the same email address and password, and you can log into your Microsoft email or your Gmail. It depends on how you have set it up. So one of your points was to keep it separate. Of course, if you have different usernames and different passwords for every website, now keeping track of it becomes hard and you can forget. So it's a little balanced, but I think you were on that one extreme where you really want to keep it separate. So how do you do that?
So, going back for a moment to the point of the same password for different websites, like we already, like over the years, had this situation like Yahoo was hacked and all the passwords were leaked and people tried to use those passwords to exactly log, like, for example, LinkedIn, Facebook, and other websites, and they were working because people like decided like to have their life easier, and suddenly like you can access different places. And so, for example, I have a different password for every website. So I started doing this. I started using password like LastPass, which was it's a nice app that allows you to like store all the passwords securely in one place and then have one master password to autofill all the forms when you try to go to a website. Nowadays, I'm using like Keychain on my Mac because it's a built-in feature. And it's more convenient that way. And the cool thing about this is like you don't have to remember the password. You can make a super crazy password that you might even not know, don't know the password. Like I think like half of my website, I have no idea what they are because I generate them randomly. And this way, even if someone stole my password from one system, it won't work on the other one. I go now even crazier than this by I always now try to create a new email for each account that I have, right? So I use Gmail. Gmail allows you to create aliases very quickly. And so I do that every time I have a new account. I say like, oh, let's say, I don't know, some random words, name of the service, my email. And then even if you get my password now, it won't work in a different place because else you need to know like what email did I use, right? And so now suddenly you have two things that are different instead of just one. I also try to enable two-factor authentication on all the sites that supports it. So this way, not only the login, the email is different, the password is different. You have a second device that you need to use to authenticate to an account. And people say like, I'm crazy, right? But I experienced this thing where like I thought that I'm good, I'm okay, I'm secure, I know enough about technology and computer that I won't have any problems, and I did have a problem, right? And after that accident, I decided to make my life a little bit more annoying, but I'm at least trying to do the right thing, I think.
Yeah, and also the flip side of the equation where we are talking about people who are developing websites for users. And we do want people that come to our websites to feel secure. So not only that we don't want our passwords to be out in the open or other people to get access to our accounts, we don't want our users to lose access to their accounts. So one thing that we can absolutely do, and a lot of companies and a lot of websites are doing that, but not everybody, And as new developers or people who are coming up and trying to build new websites, let's make sure that we force people to use secure practices, our users. And how do we do that? We can make them use strong passwords, right? Don't allow passwords that are weak, that you know can be hacked easily or can be guessed easily or generated. That's one option. So make the minimum password length pretty long. That's one idea. Then another thing that I'm really surprised by is the fact that a lot of websites that I visit don't allow spaces, for instance, and special characters. Some places they say we can't have special characters in passwords, or we can't have spaces. Well, that makes it very hard to randomize a password. A lot of people have talked about this XKCD comic where the guy was explaining that if you have a long phrase, it's easy for you to remember a phrase, just lots of words. My horse. Like I have a horse that is brown. That is an easy thing to remember, but it's a long set of characters that's going to take a very long time for a computer to generate. So that's an idea. It has spaces. In some cases, you might have other special characters that are not normally used. So just to throw the crackers off a little bit, some people don't allow that. So first of all, I think you can make sure that when you build a website that you do allow that. That's one. And you encourage people to have strong passwords. And we talked about two-factor authentication. So two-factor authentication, let's describe that for people who don't know.
Yeah, so two-factor is actually like a very simple thing to implement because there's like modules and stuff that people already wrote. And this is an old standard where you generate like a random string of whatever. You keep this string on your server and you send it to the user. And the idea is like you display a QR code on your page. The user can use an app, for example, like Google Authenticator, scan the code, which has this the secret. So now like the server has the secret and your phone have it, right? So there are two places that have this and finger crossed nobody else. And then based on the time, a 6-digit PIN is going to be generated, right? So every 30 seconds, you get a new PIN and based on this secret key. And so the cool thing is like the two devices don't have to communicate with each other. It's just offline completely. So this way, like there's nothing people can hack the communication in any way. I mean, they can see like on your screen all the PINs, but you know, they would stop working after 30 seconds anyway. And the flow is very simple. Like if you had this feature on your website, the user will go there, click enable, they will receive this QR code, which you have to scan. And immediately your app is going to pick this up and display the first PIN that is generated. Then you put this PIN on the website to confirm that you enabled two-factor authentication correctly. If the PIN is correct, the user have this thing enabled, right? And now the next time you try to log in, you type your login and password, and the login page should like ask you like, hey, put this 6-digit PIN to verify that you have access to the second device, right? And the idea is also like not to send this piece of information through the same device that you're trying to log in. So if we were to receive an email with a PIN, it's kind of pointless because we're receiving it on the same device that you're trying to log in from, right? So if someone like sit in front of your computer, let's say you go for a coffee and your coworker tries to log in and they need to put the two-factor authentication, if you receive an email, well, then they can just read the email, copy the PIN and get access, right? If you were using your phone, you go for a coffee, someone tries to log in, they see the two-factor authentication page and they go like, I don't have access to this phone, so they cannot go through the login process. And that's why it's important to have like the two-factor to be like a completely different device. Ideally, zero communication with like the internet. So it's a very simple thing to implement, especially in Node.js. I don't know, other different languages for sure, they have like the same libraries that you can just use. And it's super trivial to do.
Yeah, it's something that's coming up. It's not universally implemented. And there are different ways of doing it. As you said, two-factor authentication basically means that you don't just rely on username and passwords. You have another way of authenticating. And usually you enforce that. Sometimes have it optional.
Yeah, but the thing that they would say, like, people don't, I think they don't even try to either, like, first of all, like, if people don't, they are not mindful about security, they won't even know that this thing exists, right? So that's one sad part about this situation. But the second one is, like, for sure they think, like, oh, two-factor needs to be, it must be complicated, because, like, back in the day, like, banks used those. They were giving you, like, a dongle that you had to carry with you that was generating those PIN codes based on that secure, like, string. And so I think, like, in people's mind, like, oh, two-factor complicated, I don't have time or the skill, the knowledge to do it. But in reality, it's like, literally, I would take you 3 days to do it from start to finish, no problem, very simple and easy. So if you heard of it and thought about doing it, just do it. I guarantee you, like, it's going to be a simple thing. It's not complicated, and the flow is very basic. So, and it adds a lot of security to your account.
Yeah, it makes you look professional.
Oh, yeah.
Professional developers should think about their users. They think about their well-being, their security, and all that. It's very easy now these days because there's a very popular Google Authenticator app that has presumably a very easy API to use.
You don't have an API. You don't need an API. That's the cool part. It's like completely offline.
Okay.
Right? The app is just like, the app just reads that secure string. You can either do it like with a QR code to make the user life easier, but there is even an option that you can literally like type it by hand if you like hate yourself that much. But the app literally just stores this code and just generates every 30 seconds that PIN based on this code and the time. And so there's no API, no nothing. Like, the app is just there to make your life easier. That's it.
So essentially, you have a key or some kind of string or a key, as you're mentioning. Mm-hmm. That key is used using a known algorithm, which I'm not sure what it is right now.
Yes.
But, and then you can generate a token with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a number with that. And you can only do it if you have that random thing that you just generated. And since you're the website developer, you generated it, you have it. And by the Google Authenticator app scanning that, they have it too.
Mm-hmm.
So now only two entities in the world have it. And using the same algorithm, they're going to generate the same number. And then once you enter it, it would be very easy to your application to know if you did it. And as David mentioned, you don't have to implement this because there are plugins and there are libraries and lots of different ways of doing it in pretty much any programming language.
Yeah.
If you want to do it, you can, and it's a very good idea to do it. Okay, so we talked about that. Let's also talk about, while we're at it, HTTP and HTTPS, which is another thing that's easy. And obviously, I'm guilty of doing that because if you go to mentoringdevelopers.com, it's on HTTP, not HTTPS. I didn't get around to doing it, but it's very easy these days because HTTPS is a secure version of your website. And the way it works is that you use what's called SSL or Secure Socket Layer, right? And then you need tokens. I'm sorry, you need a certificate on your website that tells everybody that you are a legitimate purveyor of, you know, website content. You are who you are, who you claim to be.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The point is like to just tell whoever visit the website that you are who you're pretending to be.
Right.
To say like, yeah.
And so somebody has to trust somebody. There has to be some entity that we trust, and that entity has to verify who we are. And that entity provides us with a certificate, which we can then use to do encryption. And the other entity will know for sure that what we claim to be is who we are, because they also trust that other entity. And those entities are called certificate authorities. And now there is a free one. It used to be that you had to pay a lot of money. Now you can go and get a free SSL certificate. So it's very easy to do. And it's a reminder for me as well, because I need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
and the cool thing, the free part is like letsencrypt.org, I think. The cool thing is if you use Heroku, they have it built in now. You can literally like enable HTTPS for your website, choose the do it automatically option, and they're using Let's Encrypt to do it. And so you just push one button, done. You don't have, you don't even see your certificate. You don't have to copy it. You have no idea where it is. It's just set it up automatically for you. And every 3 months, they're going to auto-generate the certificate for you, because that's how long those certificates last for. If you were to do it like on your own server, like for example on EC2, it's a little bit of like a pain in the butt, because you have to run a script, a set up everything, and a little bit more annoying. But if you use Heroku, it's like one push of a button and you should just do it.
Right. And there are lots of people in the audience that are probably thinking, hey, what's Heroku? So let's just talk about it quickly. Heroku is this platform where it allows you to deploy your web servers or your web services, your websites, and your whatever applications into their servers. And it's a way to, it's a cloud-based service, right? So the question is, if you're developing an application in Node.js or Ruby on Rails or Python or whatever, and it's a web service or it's a website that you want people to access, you can have your own server and deploy it there. You can find a shared host, or you can deploy it on a service like in Heroku, which allows you to deploy directly from your code repository, like from your GitHub account. And then as soon as you update it, It gets a new version, compiles it, runs the test, and deploys it all for you. And you save money because you pay for the time that you use. And this is very similar to what you can do in some other platforms like Amazon, EC2, and Azure, and so on. But Heroku is very seamless from a development point of view. That's why we talk about it. And you can start for free. So it's very easy to get started. That's why we...
Yeah, and the cool thing is that basically, like, Heroku uses EC2 machines, so they're using Amazon.
They just put
like a very nice and clean interface to interact with like the craziness that Amazon is, because the interface there is like super crazy, complicated. They have a lot of products. It's very like, it's not an easy thing. Where Heroku, they just made it super simple to just deploy and have it working. And yeah, if you are on that platform, it's super simple to now enable SSL now. And especially like SSL is important when you try to send any type of forms, because if you don't enable a secure connection, anybody in the network is able to read everything that goes between the server and the client, right? So the point is also like to make sure, like not only like you know that you're connected to the website that you wanted to connect to, but when you try to send some information back to the server, that stays private to the browser and the server, so nobody can see what was going on.
Excellent point. So if you connect to a website that runs on HTTPS, or the address is HTTPS, which means it uses SSL certificates. For instance, you go to Gmail, you're going to see HTTPS. And that means that when you send something to Gmail, like you're sending an email, all of that information is encrypted. So only the person with the key that was negotiated during the SSL handshake, only that person, which means it's only Google, that can read it, right? And so, and that's why Google is really pushing for it. And Google, as the search engine, likes to have all websites in HTTPS. It's a good habit to have, but most websites, even today, are not HTTPS, are not running on HTTPS, including mine. So it's a reminder to me and to everybody else to look into that. And very easy to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I have it for my private website, which has no forums. It's just display like, you know, text on the page and an image in the background. And I also enable it because like just to do the right thing. So it's like remind me like by default, just do it. Don't even question it. Because like it again, it's like, it's something that you think it's complicated, which is a little bit. And when you're developing, you want to just develop something. You don't want to think about this. But sadly, many young developers like forget about it. They don't think about security. It's like this is something that I'm not interested in. For example, I just want to like develop something. And where if you're creating something where other people are going to use it. Yeah, the reality is like you need to start taking security seriously, because other people's life are going to be impacted by what you create and how you create it.
There is a feeling that front-end developers, people who develop front-end websites, they're not that interested in security. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. They just want to build their functionality. So we're going to talk a little bit about this. And there is a question on Stack Overflow that caught my attention, and I think we're going to include the link in show notes. So if you're listening to this podcast right now, go to the website, go to the page for this episode, and you're going to find a link where there's a very nice answer with a whole bunch of bullet points. The first point it mentions is never trust any input. I think that's a very, very good point, especially when it comes to front-end development. What's your experience with that? You've worked with front-end developers. What do you think about this, David?
The important part to realize is like never trust an input, but in the front-end, it's not such a big deal because the front-end should like make sure like create a good user experience. So for example, let's say you're trying to type the password and you forget about it. The UI should like, you know, notify you with a red icon, text box, whatever, that hey, you forgot your password, right? But you should never ever you should always like check if all the inputs are correct on the backend, because the backend is where like nobody in theory have access to, and in the backend you can make sure like, okay, is the password in place, is the password of the right length, is the email correct, is the email like with the right format, right? Because if you make only those checks in the front end, anybody that is on your page have access to your JavaScript code, and this person can change anything on your website. And this is something like I realize a lot of people like don't think about this, and they're like sometimes surprised, like, oh, wait a moment, I can edit everything and anybody can do it. And so doing those checks in the front end is a user experience. Doing those checks in the back end is like a security thing. And you should always do it in that place. Like the back end should be like the last place which tells you, is this data correct or not?
So we have different layers of security. When you have validation, you should have validation on the client or your browser, because that's fast and that's efficient. But the ultimate validation and ultimate security is in the backend, because that's where your data lives. If your user interface gets garbled because something happened, that's okay. You can just reload the page, or you can close your browser and start again, as long as your data is good. So you don't want bad data or untrustworthy data to get into your system. And for instance, let's give an example of the different types of attacks or malicious content that can get into your data or your application. There is something called SQL injection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, SQL injection is something that can be handled very easily. But if you're just starting out and you're building an application, you say, I am going to allow people, for instance, to run to search for things, for instance, search on this term, search for articles, search for whatever you're serving. And then you say, okay, when I get that text from the user, I'm going to take it and I'm going to generate a SQL query. And I'm going to say, select something, something from this table where this name or identity or this field equals this thing that I just got from the user. If you make a naive query like that, you are setting yourself up for an attack in the form of badly created, but I couldn't find a word for it. So bad SQL input. That's going to actually run a random SQL query on your website, and they can probably make a guess on what your data structure or your database looks like. And they can not only extract data, but they can also remove things, they can insert things, they can just cause all kinds of havoc. It's very easily fixed if you use best practices, but you have to know best practices in order to use them. For instance, there you can create queries using parameters, which is now part of all database systems, including MySQL. It didn't used to be, but now it is. But if you know how to do it, then you create your queries in the right way, and everything comes into a parameter. It's not text concatenated. That helps you out. And that's all you need to know, right? If you know that problem goes away.
And also I think a good idea is to use ORMs, which normally like add an extra layer on top of your query. So you're not writing raw queries. So normally like also the idea of ORM is to make sure that you don't have SQL injections. So even if this is not something that you're a strong suit, just by using one of those ORMs, popular ones, you're safe, you know, at least in that regard.
Right. So let's talk about ORMs. So ORMs are these software packages, essentially. This is pieces of software that take an idea or a concept that you have in terms of data. You want to get some data, you want to manipulate some data, and convert that internally into commands for the database. For instance, convert it into a SQL, right? But you don't have to implement SQL in your own code. You write your idea. So you want to say, let me get all of these records that fulfill this criteria, and you give that command to the ORM in the ORM language, right? Whatever the ORM uses, whatever it could be text-based, it could be an API, like a Fluent type API, whatever it uses, and then internally converts it. When it does convert it, it makes sure that it prevents SQL injection. So right. What David is saying is that if we use those software packages, which are built into a lot of programming languages, like Ruby on Rails has built in ORM in a lot of programming languages and platforms, such as ASP.NET and Java Beans and so on, you can use them and they're very popular. And if you follow the best practices again, it will become very natural and then it'll just happen. But in a lot of cases, when you're starting out, you may not know them, you may be intimidated by it, and you may think, well, I need raw speed, or you need to really get down to the metal and see how things work. So it's okay to create your own queries. Just make sure you use parameters, parameter-based queries. And I have been in situations where I've seen raw SQL all over the place. So in the real world, raw SQL is used. Sometimes people think that gives them extra power. Some people don't trust ORMs. And certainly it is the case that certain ORMs are very slow. In the .NET world, there is a Microsoft sanctioned or Microsoft developed ORM called Entity Framework, which is a very nice ORM framework because it gives you a very nice API. You can type queries very easily and it gives you a lot of ability, but it comes at a cost of speed. Speed of execution is very slow. So then you can maybe pick another ORM that's not sanctioned by or not developed by your company of choice, like in the case of ASP.NET. Let's find another ORM that's maybe a micro ORM, maybe a very thin ORM that gives you some protection and some facility without being overbearing, and it's still pretty fast. So there are some options. If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're thinking, I'm really curious about this ORM business, and I want to know what kind of ORMs I can use for whatever programming language or framework you're interested in, send me an email. My email address is us@mentoringdevelopers.com. I'll help you out. Or I can get you in touch with people who can help you out. Would love to know more about your problems, your issues, what you're dealing with at work. If you are interested in security, we are going to have a follow-up episode. I think this is a good length. We're going to conclude this episode right now, but we're going to have a follow-up episode that we're going to go more into some ways we can keep our application secure. And I think you're going to really enjoy that episode if you like this one. So the show notes and links for this episode are going to be at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode59, because this is episode 59. And we're going to have to stop now and we'll continue in the next part of this episode. So David, what do you think? You think that we were able to cover some important security topics?
Yeah, I think like it's a good start, especially if you like never thought about this. Good topics to like Google for yourself, the research, read some articles, learn more. There is one thing that I might that might help you out. It's like a plug for a different podcast, which is called like Security Now. If you Google Security Now, you'll find it with Steve Gibson. It's way, way more advanced than whatever we just talked about. He goes into like all the smallest details when it comes to security. So at first it might be very scary and daunting, but it's a good thing to at least listen every week to get a general idea like what's happening in the security world, because there's a lot of stuff happening. You might think like, oh, there is no issue, like who is going to hack me or like who is going to hack my account or whatever. Trust me, there are people that are doing it literally like every day, every second. There's always something happening. So this will give you like open your eye to like this world and what's what it is.
All right. So this has been Arsalan Ahmed and David Gatte on security. And we're going to be back with more security. Go back and check out episode 59 show notes, again, at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode59. Send me an email at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. What's your contact info, David?
Oh, you can hit me up on Twitter at David Gatti, or also like on Instagram. Those are the two best places to get in touch with me.
Awesome. And our Twitter handle is @mentoringdevs. See you guys later. Hi, folks. Arslan here again. Do you ever wonder if you're getting paid what you're worth? Now, salary is a taboo subject in the US and North America and the world in general. We don't really know if we are getting paid enough for the type of work that we're doing, where we live, and so on. Nobody talks about it. So if you're curious about it and you want to get an insight into how much you might get paid and what's the sort of general salary trend in the world and in the US in particular, you're curious about that? Go ahead and sign up for my mailing list, where I'm going to send you emails and essentially anecdotal reports and some really firsthand reports on how much you can expect to get paid. I'm working on that and I'd like you to be a part of it. So go ahead and go to mentoringdevelopers.com/list. mentoringdevelopers.com/list. I'll see you there.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.